to the show, my friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. I am still in the dark as to the results of the election this week. You're getting this on Friday at the earliest, so that's old news to you guys. It may still be current news. I don't know. Who knows? I mean, remember years ago we had the hanging Chad problem, and that strung the election results out for weeks and weeks and weeks. Hopefully that's not the case as you're listening, but as I'm speaking, I have no idea as to what's going on. So we're not going to talk about that now, but I did want to remind you that before I do this show, Tuesdays are my broadcasting days, which means, by the way, if you want to call in, you're welcome to do so. And the number is 855-243-9975. That's the Southern California number that you can call during showtime, which is 4 to 6 p.m. Los Angeles time, which is no longer daylight savings. It's getting dark now. And it's so creepy when they change this over. It's 6 o'clock at night, and I feel like it's 9, one of those things. And then when they change it back again, it throws me for the loop as well. Some people say a lot of folks die when they keep changing these dates around. I am not personally in favor of daylight savings time. And but, you know, we're stuck with it. In any event, that's the time you call, 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays, Los Angeles time, that's Pacific time, whether daylight or regular, 855-243-9975. Now, I do those broadcasts on Tuesday. But Tuesday morning, Amy and I do STR Ask. I'll make that hashtag STR Ask. And we have a great time. I love doing this with Amy. It's actually easier than doing the regular radio show. And the reason is, this may sound strange to some of you, but if I do the regular radio show, I'm responsible for all the dead air, okay? So if I stop talking, that's dead air, right? Okay, and if you're listening, driving in your car or something, you hear dead air, you push the button and go somewhere else. Now, I just gave away my age when I say push the button, because that's the old style, pushing the button. I don't know what they do now. I don't like the newfangled versions. I rent a car and I can't figure out how to drive the thing. You don't even need a key anymore, for goodness sake. But so you don't like dead air. And so I've got to keep talking and talking and talking. But when I'm on with Amy, it's a conversation and it's much easier because she's the host. And if I stop talking, it's her job to start talking. She reads the question to me that you send in and hashtag STR Ask, and then I do my best to respond to it. Then she gives her 2 cents, and then we move to another question. So there is a certain kind of ease for me personally in that, so I feel very relaxed in that environment. Plus, I love working with Amy. She does a great job, and she always offers something substantive to flesh out the point of view that I offer. So it's a 1-2 punch from Amy and I that you guys get as a listener. If you are not subscribing to, and it costs nothing, by the way, if you're not subscribing to hashtag STRS, just go to our website and subscribe. You get this on a regular basis, you'll get that. This is 2 1-hour shows. That's weekly. They're supposed to be 20 minutes, but we usually go about 25 or 26 minutes because we just can't help ourselves. The questions we get are so fun and so interesting, we just got to keep jabbering on about it. But many people really, really like that. And so I just want to commend it to you. This is something that we do that's just a lot of fun, and it gives a little different it has a different kind of voice or feel than the regular radio show, and we're dealing with questions that come up, so you don't know what's going to come up next, which is make kind of like the radio show, but you also get Amy's input as well, and that is really, really helpful, the two of us doing it together. So that's hashtag STR Ask. And by the way, that whole program goes forward because people send in questions. And if you go to Twitter and put hashtag STR Ask in the tweet and then ask your question, being limited by your requisite letters, then that goes right to me. Now, there is somehow some kind of magic. Amy understands it. Everybody else under 70 seems to understand it. I still don't quite get it. But if that phrase hashtag STR Ask is in the note, even if you put it somewhere else and you stay within the limit of the letters, that helps Amy, then she'll be able to reach into the ionosphere of the cloud or the internet or that ethereal world and snatch your questions out, put them on paper, and then we'll discuss those. So that's the way we do hashtag STRask. Love to have you part of it, either as a listener or as a questioner. A quick reminder, we still are moving forward apace with Reality for Minneapolis. I told you a couple of days ago, if you listened, we're at 221 people that have signed up. We can max out at 1,500. That's 279 that are left. I suspect in the last few days, more people have signed up. We're going to have a sellout in what for me is almost 2 weeks in Minneapolis, and I want you there. So I want you to go to reality apologetics.com. You can actually go to str.org and I think click through. But if you just go to realityapologetics.com, you get all the information. Jay Warner Wallace will be there. Alisa Childers will be there. She's a Zoe girl, or formerly a Zoe girl. Maybe that's the way you remember her if you're old enough. That would be 20 years ago. Now she's written a best-selling book called Another Gospel, excuse me, that has to do with progressive Christianity. And that's a huge problem in the church right now, and she speaks to it so effectively in the book and in her presentations. She'll be doing a main stage presentation and a workshop. John Noyes will be there. Alan Schliemann will be there. I will be there. Amy, I don't think you're going to be there. You are going to be there. Okay, you were not at Reality, but you'll be at Minneapolis. We'll be thrilled to see you. We got our whole gang. I think Jeff Myers will be there too. Is that right? Is Jeff Myers going to be part of that? I know Christopher Ewan was there in Seattle, but I thought they're switching out for Minneapolis. Not sure. Amy's looking it up. Nevertheless, yes, it is. Okay, Jeff Meyer, president of Summit Ministries. This guy knows how to speak to young people. So does everybody on our staff, but me. I survive. I manage, but the other people are fabulous. And so this is the thing you want to take. You are a young person. You're middle school or your high school or your youth group too. And by the way, if you're not in those grades, we're not going to leave you out in the snow. All right. And there is snow there now. Right. As far as I understand, we're not checking IDs. We want you there. We have a capacity of 1,500 and we're looking for that and we should fill it up. So that's my strong encouragement for you to be part of that. All right. Let's see what else. I have a question here that's been sent. No, let me do this. As you know, because we've talked about this before, there are times when as our staff gets together, and now it's kind of like Hollywood Squares, if any of you old folk remember what that looks like. We're all on screen, right? All the squares. Because we're doing Zoom together for our staff meetings, but we'll knock around ideas to learn from each other. And it turned out that last week when we had our staff meeting, Tim Barnett was asking for feedback and help about a talk he was giving on hell. Now, many of you know that Tim and I wrote a series of articles in Solid Ground about hell, and we were defending the what they call ECT, I guess, eternal conscious torment. Now, this is an unenviable position, because it's hard to be the person who's going rah, rah, rah for eternal conscious torment. But that is the classical view of the church regarding hell. And we think that it's the correct biblical view. And so this is why in our pieces, the three-part section in Solid Ground that you can get online at str.org, titled Hell Interrupted, this is the way we argue against other Christians who genuinely and in good conscience think that hell is not like that, that eventually those who don't go to heaven get annihilated, at least initially or maybe after a period of punishment, and then they're gone. But it's not eternal conscious torment. That is a bit much on their view, and I respect that, all right? Now, it turns out in this particular situation that we were talking about at the staff meeting, Tim had been invited And so had I, but I wasn't, I thought Tim would be a better person to do this, to speak at a conference on hell where there were people with different views, but it was a conference about hell and apologetics. So how can you offer an apologetic, a defense, make the case for hell? And again, it's one of those hard jobs, you know. And by the way, perfect justice is fiery torment forever. Now, let me give you six good reasons why you ought to believe that wonderful doctrine. You know, it's kind of a hard place to be at. And so that's why I wanted Tim to do it and not me. But what we talked about is a strategy. How could we position ourselves in a way that made the doctrine that we are convinced is biblical most palatable to people? And the doctrine of hell, as Tim put it, is a kind of what he called a gospitical, which is like a gospel obstacle. I can't say it, but you get the point. Gospitical. And what we need to do is to do our best as apologists, defenders of the faith, defenders of classical Christianity and classical Christian values, is remove that gospitical and show that, well, the way he puts it is that hell is actually a solution and not a problem. It's a solution to something. So I thought I'd just run some ideas by you. I know he's done this was a talk he was going to give online, and that would be exported then to the conference, which he was not able to attend in person because he's stuck in Ontario, Canada, and can't cross the border. The ideas that he had were good ones, and we worked together to refine them. But I just want to offer a couple of thoughts to you, because one of these ideas was something I'd never actually thought about before. And what Tim suggested is that one of the strategic elements of his approach is to watch our language. Now, that's the title of a tactic in which I describe being careful about using religious language that is easily misunderstood or just sounds like religious noise. Now, in this particular case, it's a strategic move, but it's a similar category. That is, the word hell conjures up all kinds of images that not all Christians agree with, all right, and that are sometimes kind of inaccurate. Do you know how many people actually think that hell is where Satan lives? And Satan is in charge of hell? And I've actually seen dramas, like Christian dramas, going to churches. And it came to a church I had attended at one point. And the drama was predicated on the notion that two people, one a Christian and one not a Christian, die, and they meet in the intermediate realm, and then they are each escorted away to their proper end. The Christian by a white-robed Jesus, all with his hands clean and glowing and everything's nice, and he takes the Christian away to glory, and he leaves the demons to drag the non-Christian into the fiery hell. Now, this has got great, great dramatic impact, and lots of people become Christians, but the fact is it's an inaccurate picture because it pictures Jesus as like too clean to filthy himself and dirty himself with the task of punishment. When in fact, hell is God's place. It's what God created to accomplish a just end, and that is punishment. And the devil's not in charge there. He is imprisoned there at the end. Read it. It's in Revelation chapter 20. All right. So that's a misconception that people have. They think of the devil as some guy in red tights and a pitchfork and hoofs and all the horns and all this other stuff, or they're tempted to think of someone like that, and it's just a little ridiculous. Or they're thinking of hell with fire in it, and, you know, I don't know if there's fire in hell. Wait a minute, doesn't the Bible talk about the fiery hell? I said, yeah, but it's also a place of darkness in which there's wailing and gnashing of teeth. So if there's fire, how is there darkness? Well, it's a dark fire. Well, then it's not a literal fire, is it? the point really is, as far as I'm concerned, as whatever is going on there, it ain't nice and you don't want to go there. So one of the liabilities we have in talking about hell, and now we're thinking from an apologetic perspective, if we're going to talk with others about hell, maybe we should not talk about hell. In other words, we don't use the word that conjures up false understandings of hell, of the final judgment, and are controversial even among Bible-believing Christians. Now, it doesn't mean we don't take a stand on that. Tim and I did in the series that we did called Hell Interrupted. So we have a point of view here. But the question isn't one of answering the issue among family. This is a family issue. In my view, it's kind of like the inerrancy question. That's a family issue. This is something we talk about in the house. It doesn't have relevance in talking with people who are not Christians, whether the Bible's inerrant or not. That's a distraction, in my view. I believe it is inerrant, but I think it's a distraction. There's another direction that we encourage people to go on this. And the same thing with hell. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about hell as such, but rather about the thing that we all agree on, and that is that there is going to be a final judgment, and it won't be pretty. Okay? That's the deal. Now, here, I'll tell you something crazy. I didn't know this until Tim mentioned it. But he said when he goes through the book of Acts and looks at the preachments in the book of Acts, which I have done, and I have a record of it on our website. I think it's titled The Preaching of the Gospel in the Book of Acts or something to that effect. I took a look at the things that were what the apostles said when they preached. And these are the guys, keep in mind, that Jesus personally trained to take the message after him. And they never talk about hell. Or probably more specifically, they don't use the word hell. But they almost uniformly talk about judgment. There will be a judgment day. Everyone's going to be judged, Paul says, and they're going to be judged by a man that God appointed, having verified him by raising him from the dead. That's Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus himself says, all judgment is given to me. And by the way, if you don't believe in me, you're judged already. It's a fait accompli, man. It's a done deal. Because you have broken God. Everyone has broken God's law, and we are guilty before God as a result. And that's what the great white throne judgment is all about. And so what ought to be emphasized, Tim has suggested, and I think there's great wisdom here, and you may want to take counsel from this, is that when we talk about the end, the final thing, we talk about judgment. Or, as I put it in the story of reality, justice. Perfect justice. Now I'm thinking, I wonder if I think I do mention the word hell there. But I am thinking about it and talking about it in terms of final justice, proper retribution, judgment for crimes committed. So when people say, well, I can't believe in a God who would send who want to throw a bunch of people in fiery hell, maybe the question could be to them, so are you saying that there's something unloving about God punishing guilty, evil people? Because that is the nature of judgment. Now, notice I changed the language in such a way as to more accurately capture what's going on in the final scenario, instead of letting the rhetorical maneuvers of people complaining about fiery hell where God wants to just fry people and torture them forever, instead of letting that do the work, because I think that's misleading. Why is it misleading? Because it makes God look like he's a tormentor and he likes tormenting instead of God doing what he ought to be doing, and that is justice. And incidentally, and this is another point that Tim brought up, that we emphasize the judgment. And the judgment is something that we all want. Now, we don't want it for ourselves, but we do want it for others. Have you ever noticed when you see a movie where the bad guy's really bad and you're waiting and waiting and waiting to the end for the bad guy to get his comeuppance, and you don't want him to get it too quickly. You want him to go down slowly so he knows that he is getting his comeuppance. He's dying or being punished because of the crimes that he's committed. If he trips a wire and just blows up like that, man, for me, it's not so satisfying. He's gone. I'd like to see the look in his eyes when he says, I've been caught and now I'm going to get it for what I've done wrong. That's what I want to see. I just watched one of the Bourne movies last night. We love that series, the third one. And there was Noah, what's his name? Goshen or whatever it is. Noah Foshan or whatever. One of the CIA bad guys, and there he is. And he's been arrested and he's going in the car. And that's right at the end of the movie. And you're going, all right, he got the bad guy. What's going on there? Inside of us, we're having this thing going on. There's something that is appealed to there, and that thing that's appealed to is an innate sense of justice that we want to be satisfied. If there is no final judgment, read hell if you like, if there's no judgment, then there is no justice. And if there is no God, there is no judgment. All right? So the atheists who object to God because, oh, hell, really? Come on, are you kidding me? Please. Well, these are people who then are acknowledging that the wrongs that are done in this life are never paid for. There will be no justice. Because it's not done here on earth, that's for sure. We know that. People get away with murder. Not in the long run, on my view. Not in the long run. And so when you have people rioting saying no justice, no peace, I get it. They want justice, right? I mean, I'm not affirming that all of their causes are just ones, but notice the appeal. We want justice. And if we don't get justice, you're going to hear from us. And here's what I'm saying to that. If there is no God, then there is no justice. If there is no God, there is no justice. There are no laws that are objective moral laws that determine what right and wrong amount to, what violations amount to violations of justice, and there is no ultimate reckoning in a judgment where those who have gotten away with injustice in this life have to face the music in the next. And so in this sense, and I think it's pretty clever, what Tim has argued is that hell is a solution, not a problem. And if you don't have a final judgment, then even atheists are not going to get what their hearts yearn for. They are not going to have a place or a way in which the accounts are balanced. Now, of course, that represents a liability to all of us because we are all criminals before God, but that's why the cross of Christ is so powerful. Because it's either perfect justice or perfect mercy. And perfect justice is punishment for everything you've ever done wrong, and God misses nothing. And perfect mercy is forgiveness for everything you've ever done wrong, and God misses nothing. That's really good news. Well, let's take a break here. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. More coming up.
Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
You know, if you've gained anything from listening to Stand to Reason, I'd really be thrilled to hear it from you. I love to take your questions, of course, but I also want your feedback. So here's what you can do. Head over to iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a rating and a review. That kind of thing really helps us to get the word out so more ambassadors for Christ can find the show and become equipped to stand confidently. And you never know, I might just give you a shout out on the air to show you my appreciation for your positive review. I value you as a faithful listener. I look forward to reading what you think about the show. Thanks. All right, here we go. Greg Kokel, your host, with you every week here. Actually, twice a week, because we split the show up into two segments. Giving you a piece of my mind, and that's my goal when we're talking about Christianity. And my interest is for you to give me a piece of yours, or that can be in a statement or an argument or a pushback or just a question, and we'll knock some things around. Incidentally, I had mentioned Minneapolis reality coming up. I left Bobby Conway's name off. Thanks for that. This mention, Amy, reminder. Bobby Conway's great, and we've done a lot of work with him in the past, so he's on the lineup as well. Let's go to New Jersey and Lewis. Hello, Lewis. Welcome to Stand to Reason. Glad you called.
Hi, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm a little bit on pins and needles tonight, wondering what's going to happen, but because it's Tuesday still while we're broadcasting. But in any event, it's nice to chat with you.
Ditto. Funny enough, I have your podcast app downloaded on my phone, and I just got done giving counseling to a client of mine at my internship, and I happened to see a notification from your app saying that if you're interested in asking a question about ethics, values, or religion,
right,
you can call this number from this time.
Right.
So there's actually been a question that's been on my mind pertaining to psychology and religion, specifically therapy, and I wanted to know your opinion on it.
Sure.
If you can kind of give me some biblical foundation on it.
Right.
So pretty much it has to do with differing values in clients that a therapist can see who happens to be Christian. So I, as a intern who wants to become a therapist, biblically grounded, how can I give counseling that's considered ethical to a client who happens to have a differing value or belief without me imposing my own value or belief? So an example could be a member of the LGBTQ,
yeah,
or a client who maybe it's a young woman, maybe 16 or 17 or whatever, who is considering an abortion. And me being Christian and against abortion, she may be seriously considered an abortion. How should I go about that?
I have no envy of you in the circumstance that you're in. This particular field has been especially difficult for committed Christians. But I will say that the number of fields that are going to be difficult for committed Christians, is growing rapidly because of the force of political correctness and a kind of soft totalitarianism that is taking over our culture. All right. But this is one area where for a long time you've had a very oppressive environment where leftist views have become dogma. And if you don't march to their drummer, to the beat of their drummer, you could lose your license. And by the way, it's not just professional ethics right now. It is also law. I know, for example, in the state of California, if you have a minor who is experiencing gender dysphoria, you are not allowed to counsel them towards cisgender point of view. You are required to cooperate with them in their own gender identity. That's the law. So this puts Christians in a very, very difficult spot. I'm not sure how well I'm going to be able to counsel you in this regard, okay? There's some things obviously I can say. And as on the foundational concern, I do not think that it is morally acceptable before God for you to counsel someone into a sinful situation. So you mentioned about the woman who wants to, young lady who wants to have the abortion. I know that the basic ethic, it's my understanding now, in the field of counseling, is that you want to diminish dysphoria. Right. So whatever it happens to be, not just with genders, you know, you want to, if a person feels bad about the possibility of getting an abortion, but they also feel bad about having the child, well, then you want to encourage them in the direction that they want to go and feel good about it. That's kind of what counselors are meant to do. Am I misunderstanding the field here at this point, or is that your experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much my experience. It's a very, I guess, like the philosophy of counseling would be to empower your clients, to allow them to, of their own volition and independence, to be able to make decisions to whatever, you know, situation they may be in, and do so with confidence, or at the very least with a feeling that it was okay. You know, I didn't necessarily do anything wrong, or if I did, you know, I can get past it.
Yes, but of course, that was well put, and that's the way I understand it. You said it better than I could. But do something wrong is one of those fudge terms. What do you mean do something wrong? Where is the standard of right and wrong? Well, the standard of right and wrong is just to affirm what the other person is doing and make them feel good about it. So you're wrong if you say anything that makes them feel bad about what they're doing. I mean, that's the ethic. And as far as them doing anything right or wrong, it depends. I mean, that requires there being a right and wrong, there being a standard. Now, I remember many years ago, I was on an airplane sitting next to a man. We had small conversation. I asked him what he did for a living. He said he was a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And I said, psychology is actually a good argument for God's existence. And he said, how is that so? And this may not resonate with you, Lewis, because things have changed. But this is a while ago. Then I said, well, psychology is based on the idea of mental health. That is, there's a teleology. There's a purpose. There's a way that humans are supposed to be. And if they aren't this way, they're not healthy. And so part of what doctors do, or psychologists in their arena, is to encourage people towards a right and the right direction that we call healthy. The problem is, in the field of psychology, they have abandoned the notion that there is such a thing as a healthy human being in any objective sense. And now it's just, well, what do you want? How can I help empower you to do what you want and be what you want and feel good about what you do? So if there's somebody that's a client of yours and they have sexual attraction to younger people, children even, that's not listed as like that's bad. It would be bad if they did it, but it's not bad to feel it or think it. It's just the ideal is, well, what can we do to help you feel better about having that desire? This is twisted. This is totally twisted. And of course, you know, if as a Christian, we understand the nature of reality is such that human beings were made for certain things. They were made for virtuous things. There is a good and a bad. And so as Christians, our goal is to counsel people towards health, but that's a particular thing. And health has moral connotations. So if we are therapists as Christians, then we can't counsel a person in the direction of moral brokenness, of unhealthy behavior or thinking. We have to do that in the direction of healthy behavior or thinking. Now, in your field, with the professional values that are promoted now, that's very hard to do. And it may be in certain circumstances you can find ways to help people that are living in lifestyles that are not good for them, that are immoral, and try to encourage them in ways that will help them live healthier lifestyles without bringing judgment into the discussion. Okay? And I think that would be a direction you want to go. But you can't encourage people to do things that are wrong. I don't see how that's on the table for you as a Christian therapist. Which means then, if you could try to do the first, but you can't do the second, you've got to be really shrewd in the way you maneuver in conversations. And it may be that you have to kind of recuse yourself from certain counseling relationships. If you're going to be kind of open-ended, you're just in the field. Now, if you're part of a Christian organization and you're not part of those professional organizations that won't allow you to be part of their organization unless you walk lockstep with their point of view, and unless you let them impose their view on you, you know, if that's the situation, and you can't do that, then you've got to say, okay, I'm not going to be part of your organization. Which means you're not going to be credentialed properly in the minds of many people, and you're going to have to limit your interactions with people who are with organizations that are Christian and not part of that whole enterprise. All right, but then you also have to face the problem now of dealing with the law in certain states, and sometimes the law is draconian in how it governs what you can say. And so you mentioned about imposing your views. You don't want to impose your views. Everybody imposes their views. Everybody does. And, I mean, let's face it, even the what's the manual? No, I can't remember the name of it. The DSM.
So that
manual imposes its views of what it thinks mental health is. And as you know, it's highly political now. It's very politicized for the last 30 years, you know. And so it tells you what is mentally healthy based on what the politics of the era determine, and leftist people. And what are they doing? They're imposing their will on you. They're telling you what you can say and what you can't say, and what you can approve of and what you can't approve of. And then they have the audacity to say, if you're a Christian, you can't impose your will on your client. Huh? This is all about imposing will in a bullying kind of way from the other side. So, I mean, I'm just kind of throwing some things out here for you that I think make the pursuit of your chosen profession very, very difficult if you're a committed follower of Christ, if you are working in the midst of the standard counseling community. If you work in the midst of a Christian community, then you are restricted only by law, or whatever requirements may be in place to have you certified properly as a counselor, MFCC or whatever. And that's where, you know, other organizations might come in and say, well, since you don't celebrate abortion, then we're going to take our licensing away from you. Well, I don't know what choice you have in a situation like that, because you can't celebrate taking somebody else's life like that. And so it's going to be a cost to you in your profession to do the right thing. I mean, advice is cheap here because I don't have to face that at the moment, but a lot of Christians are, and in that discipline especially so.
Yeah, that's a good point. Thank you for your response. I mean, unfortunately, you're right. It seems like particularly the social sciences are very left, to the left. And because of it, it's almost kind of like a group think, like where the conservatives are the minority, and if you're against what the majority thinks, well, then you're kind of like either pushed to the side or punished for it.
Yeah, that's right. That's called soft totalitarianism. It's not the government doing so much. It's the structures of culture that have power over individuals in different ways. Employers do this. And the school system does this. You know, the school boards indoctrinate children according to political views. It's not their job, but they control the school board and they get it done. You send your kid to a public school, they're going to be indoctrinated with a particular political view, period. It's built in. They shouldn't be doing it. They shouldn't be imposing their views. They shouldn't be bullying people who disagree, but it happens all the time. Even here in Thousand Oaks, I live in Thousand Oaks. It's like a very conservative community in Ventura County here in Southern California. A very low crime rate, for example. One of the lowest in the country, fortunately for us. However, you know, the school board is very, very leftist. One conservative. That's it. And they do what they want, and they bully everybody else into submission. This is largely the teachers' union itself that does the same thing, as I understand it. So it's a tough situation. Here's what I would recommend to you, Lewis, is that you find other Christian counselors who are very committed to Christ and see if you can get some wisdom from them as to how they maneuver through these difficult circumstances. I mean, that's what I would do. People that are in the same circumstance that you are and have visibility. Remember I said you're going to have to maneuver in a shrewd fashion if you're going to be in that larger community and still stay licensed.
Right.
Well, I think that maybe they can turn you on to some shrewd moves that have helped them to dodge the bullying and the challenges that they're facing there and still do something productive in the lives of people who genuinely need your help.
Right. Yeah, that's a good idea. I know I've gotten some names of certain professors, I think from Biola,
mm-hmm.
who are psychologists, and they also give therapy to try to see what's the process of how they can give counseling in a way that's biblically grounded as a committed Christian without having to forsake their values.
Well, there is a school of psychology associated with Biola called Rosemead. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that. Rosemead, it's a graduate school, but it's associated with Biola. Pardon me?
No, I'm just saying I think it does sound familiar.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is something... Are you a student at Biola now? I'm trying to remember what you said at the beginning, or maybe you didn't.
No, I'm not a student at Biola. I just got some information from, I think it's one of the representatives of Reasonable Faith, that he gave me some names of some psychologists. I actually go to university on the East Coast.
Okay, so are you a grad? Are you going into grad school or grad student now or undergrad? What circumstance are you in?
I'm a grad student now.
Are you a grad student in a psychology program on the East Coast?
Yeah.
And you're destined for a counseling degree of some sort to do clinical work, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't envy you. I wish I had something nicer to say. I really do, Lewis. But you are going into the lion's den. All right. And this reminds me of something that Winston Churchill said regarding those who are seeking to appease Hitler. All right. In the early stages of the threat of Hitler before full-out war was declared. And not that you are trying to appease. That's not what I'm suggesting. But there are a lot of Christians who are trying to appease. They're trying to kind of get along with the system that is not a kind of system that at the heart of it, Christians can get along with. All right. And anyway, Churchill said, you cannot negotiate with a lion when your head is in its mouth.
Wow, that's a good quote.
Yeah, it's a good line, man. It's great.
Yeah.
And just like Churchill. But it, at the same time, but the point is, well taken, I think, that your head is in the lion's mouth if you're moving into that circumstance. And you could easily be bumped out of a program. I know this has happened because I've talked to the attorneys who've litigated it and lost. You could be in a program that has to do with this field and not hold the right viewpoint. Never mind what you're counseling clients. You can't hold the, if you don't hold the right viewpoint, you could be kicked out of the program. And all the money and effort that you've spent to get as far as you had in the program will be for naught. There will be no way to reclaim that because now you're a pariah to that discipline because you don't believe the right things. In the case that I was just referring to, there was a student who confided in another student privately that she did not believe in same-sex marriage, and this is before Obergefell. It was before the Supreme Court made the decision in favor of same-sex marriage, so she was giving an opinion in private that was consistent with the law of the land, and she was ejected from her graduate program. It happens.
Yeah, I've heard of a few court cases where essentially the grad student didn't agree with one of their values and they were put through a, I think, some sort of course to try. I guess I don't want to say brainwashed, but
you don't want to say
like
what?
I don't want to say brainwashed.
No, it's not brainwashing. I don't believe in brainwashing. I don't think it's possible. You know, I think that's a misnomer, but certainly there can be. There can be indoctrination, brutal indoctrination. I only mean brutal in the sense that if you don't go along with us, we're going to really hurt you badly. And so, you know, people just, they just go along and they can't raise objection to these things because the forces at B, that the powers at B are too strong and they have too much influence and they can hurt you too much. They can oppress you, quite literally, because you don't believe the right thing. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Lewis?
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it. You know, you've really put things in perspective for me and give me something to really think about.
Well, I hope I haven't ruined your day or your career, all your study.
No, my day is great. My day is fine.
Yeah, well, God keep you, okay, and God's mercies on you in this tough field that you find yourself in, all right?
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, Lewis, all the best. Bye-bye now. Oh, man. I use the phrase soft totalitarianism because it's a new one that I've learned from a book that I'm reading. I'm not prepared at the moment to talk about the book because I only have about 7 more minutes or 8 more minutes on the show. I have another caller come up just now that I want to get to. But just saying, the book is called Live Not by Lies by Rod Dreher, Dreher. And it may be that we'll have Rod on, but this is a book that I'm looking very closely at. It's not a hard read, but it's a stunner. Live Not by Lies. Those words, by the way, are from a title of an essay in 1973 written by Alexander Solzhenitsyn on the eve of his ejection from the Soviet Union. He is a Nobel laureate, writing about his experiences in the Gulag, where he spent, I think, about 10 years. And this was his recommendation to those he was leaving behind and to the rest of the civilized world. Live not by lies. Solzhenitsyn was a Christian. So we are now in an era not of state totalitarianism, but the soft totalitarianism of a culture. And it's no, well, I want to say it's no less oppressive. The consequences are less because, IBM can't send you to the gulag, or Twitter can't do that, but they can hurt you. All right. Anyway, we'll talk more about that later. Let's go to Plano, Texas. And Jackson, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're so welcome. Glad you called. Got you right at the end of the show here.
Well, thank you. I've been talking with one of my friends over the last few weeks about the cosmological argument for theism, and he's brought up a response that I think appeals to the weak anthropic principle, but I haven't really been prepared to answer it. His response was essentially that it really isn't surprising that the universe is fine-tuned the way it is, because it's the only way that we can observe it. We're experiencing the universe this way, so it's not remarkable that things are the way they are, because if they weren't, no matter what chances they are that they're arranged this way, we wouldn't be here to experience it. So I've read some responses, but they haven't seemed very convincing to me. So I was just wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, that is a standard kind of challenge to the is not the cosmological argument, it's the teleological argument. That would be an argument from design. And the fine-tuning of the universe is an argument based on design. And what's interesting is the fine-tuning is not just – there are various levels of fine-tuning, okay? We don't have time to get into all of that, and you're probably familiar with it. But to answer the challenge more directly, Richard Swinburne, a British philosopher, actually offered, a meaningful challenge to this. Let's just simply say, he gives this illustration. Let's say we have 30 men lined up with rifles. It's a firing squad. You have one man is standing against a wall. He's 15 feet or 20 feet away. Let's just call it 10 yards, all right? That's close. 15 rifles trained on him to execute him. The executioner says, ready, aim, fire. And they all pull the trigger, and every single one of them misses at virtually point blank range. Now, the person who is to be executed is not dead. He's alive, and he's wondering why everybody missed. Now, of course, you could say, well, he's only wondering why everybody missed because they just happened to miss. And if they didn't miss, he'd be dead and he wouldn't be reflecting on this. So it's just the nature of the circumstance. He wouldn't be reflecting on the unusual and highly unlikely circumstance that all of the executioners at close range firing rifles would have missed him if he had not survived. And so this, what Swinburne says, is a parallel to this rejoinder to the design argument. Anybody in the circumstance that he described would have clearly concluded that it wasn't just a wild chance that they got missed, but rather that they missed on purpose. There was a design involved here to spare the life of this man. And by the same token, when you look at the unbelievably complex nature of the refined fine-tuning of the universe, and not just the universe, and there's a lot of details there, but also of the solar system, and even of the planet, or even of individual living things, and the complexity there. You're going to see that this is not an accident, you know? This is not an accident. It can't be an accident. So
Makes a lot of sense to me.
It makes a lot of sense to most people. And in fact, even Richard Dawkins says that the fine-tuning argument is one of the most powerful arguments, and it's very hard to get around. And here's what he says. We just got lucky. We just got lucky. Well, when you look at the nature of the fine-tuning, and I heard one argument last week in Frank Turek. No, it wasn't Frank Turek. It's Doug Axe that used it a weekend before last when I was in Tucson with him. And he takes a little red light, and he, like a laser, and he puts it on the ceiling, blindfolds somebody, and he says, okay, you put your laser light and you match my laser light. Okay, in other words, you put one over the other without looking. Well, the chances are really pretty slim that that's going to happen. But he said, this isn't the way it is with fine-tuning. He said, just taking one, in this case, the fine-tuning was a protein molecule, which is Doug Axe's field. He says, let's say your laser is the size of an atom or an electron, and the ceiling that you have to match is the size of the known universe. And you have to put the electron on one spot of the known universe that matches one other electron. And that's the chances that you have of getting one properly sequenced amino acid, which is the topic of his conversation. And that's just one. That isn't the thousands and thousands of thousands of different amino acids that are necessary for even less complex living things. It's not an accident. And so that's why people, it strikes me, who are fair-minded about this kind of stuff and they look at the details that are involved, they realize that an accident is not the odds-on favorite, okay? So you might use the illustration from Swinburne. You know, or say gambling. If a guy he's playing on the wheel deal, and he puts his bet on 00 when he gets that. Well, that's pretty. Well, that's a long shot. He says, "Let it ride, 00 again." Bang! He hits it again. Let it ride again, 00 again. He hits it again. He hits 00 every single time he bets on it, which is 10 times in a row. Do you think people are going to say, "Man, that's some coincidence"? No, they're going to think it's rigged, which is the appropriate common sense response to the details. And of course, hitting 00 10 times in a row on a roulette wheel is a modest comparison to the kinds of things that we face in the very complex universe that are highly tuned. Well, Jackson, there you go. That was my quickie. I'm out of time, but I was glad that he got you in, at least gave you something to think about. Thank you so much for your call. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. Just was a pleasure to be with you all today. Give him heaven this week, all right? Bye-bye now.